This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
And I'd now like to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Darryl Lewis. You've got the bio notes, so I won't go into great detail, but Darryl is a historian and archaeologist of Northern Australia. He's been working in that area for several decades and is also a visiting fellow here at the ANU. So, Darryl, welcome, and we look forward to hearing about he nearly made it, Leichhardt's grand plan of 1848.
Right, in 1848, Ludwig Leichhardt set out to cross the continent from east to west, from Moreton Bay in Queensland to Swan River in Western Australia. And when he left the settled districts of the Darling Downs in April of that year, he had seven companions, a large number of horses, mules and bullocks, and all the equipment needed for such an expedition. And this equipment, I think, bears some thinking about. No list is known to exist, but we can assume that there were notebooks and writing gear, clothes, blankets, pots and pans, plates and mugs, cutlery, axes, chewing gear, horseshoes and nails, riding and pack saddles, harness and bullock bells, leather repair gear, guns, powder flasks, ammunition, surveying tools, and no doubt many other items. A lot of the equipment was perishable and would have disintegrated but a substantial amount was made of metal, which would survive for decades, and indeed items of brass and copper, such as bullock bells and powder flasks, and the thicker objects of iron, such as guns and axes, would survive to the present day. However, with one and possibly two exceptions, nothing identifiable as belonging to Leichhardt ever turned up. And apart from a series of trees marked L, no trace of the expedition was ever found. His disappearance is probably the greatest mystery in Australian history. Since the expedition disappeared, Aboriginal stories of whites dying or being killed beyond the frontier were recorded in many areas. And likewise, the supposed remains of white men and items of European manufacture were also discovered at various places beyond the frontier. These stories and finds were commonly assumed to be evidence of Leichhardt's fate and led to innumerable theories being propounded and quite a number of expeditions being mounted. The theories range from destruction by flash flood, death from thirst or hunger, and massacre by Aborigines. And the location where these supposed calamities occurred ranged from southwest Queensland to the Simpson Desert, the Gulf Country, Central Australia, the Lake Eyre region, Arnhem Land, Western Australia, just about everywhere except Tasmania. So after more than 150 years, what can be said about this great mystery? To answer this, I'll begin by looking at what's known about Leichhardt's plan for his east-west crossing. He first announced his intention to form an expedition to cross the continent in 1846, soon after he'd returned from his Port Essington trip. But he made it clear he wasn't planning to go in a direct line from one side to the other. Instead, he said he'd more or less follow his old Port Essington track some hundreds of kilometres to the north of Moreton Bay, then turn west and make his way across the northern third of the continent before turning south or southwest towards Swan River. Leichhardt set out to do this in December 1846, but near Peak Downs, inland from present-day Rockhampton, it rained heavily for weeks, he and his men became sick, most of his stock strayed, and the expedition failed. He returned to the Darling Downs and regrouped for another attempt, but before he set out again, he'd learnt of Major Mitchell's discovery of what is now known as the Barcoo River. Mitchell had named the Barcoo the Victoria because even though it flows consistently southwest, for some obscure reason he thought it flowed to the northwest and was a tributary of the Northern Territory's Victoria River, which runs into Cambridge Gulf nearly 2,000 kilometres away. Leichhardt also learned that Kennedy had followed up Mitchell's discovery and found that the Barcoo was actually part of the Cooper Creek system, which flows into the savage desert country discovered by Sturt. The discoveries of Mitchell and Kennedy caused Leichhardt to modify his earlier plan. So in several letters he wrote in the weeks before he entered the unknown, he said he'd go west as far as the Barcoo, follow it upstream, and cross over to the headwaters of the Gulf Rivers. To give just one example, on February 26, 1848, he wrote that we shall sail down the Condamine, go up the Colgoon, and follow Mitchell's outward track at the most northern bend of the Victoria. I shall then proceed to the northward until I come in decided water of the Gulf, and after that resume my original course to the westward. The existence of rivers along the North Australian coast was known from the explorations of Gray and Stokes and Wickham and the Dutch seafarers, and Leichhardt speculated that these rivers might have their sources in a range of mountains, in which case there'd be rivers flowing from the inland side of the range. If this proved to be the case, he said he'd try to find an inland flowing stream leading towards Swan River and follow it down. We now know there's no such mountain range, and beyond Queensland, there's only a few large creeks flowing inland, and these all end in floodouts or ephemeral lakes beyond which is waterless desert country. Now, why would Leichhardt have a plan like this, one that would add hundreds, if not thousands, of kilometres to a more direct route? Part of the answer is that he knew from Sturt's explorations that there was a terrible desert in central Australia. In fact, Leichhardt knew there was a desert in the centre before Sturt's discoveries. When he first arrived in Australia in February 1842, there were very hot winds blowing from the inland, and Leichhardt deduced that this air was hot because it flowed over a desert rather than an inland sea, as many then believed. For Leichhardt, Sturt's discoveries were confirmation rather than revelation. Avoiding the desert was clearly a smart move, but a much more important reason is that Leichhardt was fired with a grand plan. Let me explain this. Like many young scientists of his time, Leichhardt was greatly influenced by the work of the German scientist Alexander von Humboldt. We know this from one of Leichhardt's letters where he said, "As for Humboldt, he set the example that I've never forgotten. My admiration for him is boundless." So what was Humboldt's example? It was his recognition that the Earth and its oceans and atmosphere was an integrated physical system, and that flora, fauna and climate are influenced by the interaction of major geographical features, oceans, deserts, mountain ranges and so on. And because of Humboldt's work, Leichhardt was keenly aware of the need to look at the big picture. In various letters he wrote, he said he wanted to discover the northern extent of Sturt's desert, the gradual change in plant and animal life from one coast to the other, and to map the northern, northwestern and western watersheds. From these statements, we can see that Leichhardt's grand plan was to follow Humboldt's teachings by determining the major geographical and biological features of the northern half of the continent. With his knowledge of severe desert country in central Australia and the driving force of his Humboldtian aims, I believe we can safely assume that Leichhardt would not have abandoned his grand plan once he reached the Barcoo and continued westward towards a severe desert he knew was there, only to perish in southwest Queensland, the Simpson Desert, or elsewhere in central Australia, as some believe. Instead, he would have stuck to his plan to follow up the Barcoo and cross over to the headwaters of the Gulf Rivers. From there, he would have followed a generally westward course through a broad band of country, probably moving back and forth between the watersheds of the northern rivers and the inland. And there's physical evidence that he did just that. From the 1850s to the 1920s, a series of elm trees was discovered along the Barcoo and Flinders Rivers. Located on Retreat Station near the junction of the Barcoo and Thompson, and that's in this area, Retreat Station. And two more were found higher upstream near the junction of the Alice and Barcoo, which is up here, this area. And over the watershed from the upper Barcoo, a couple more were found along the Flinders River here, along a 200-kilometre stretch of the Flinders. And several more on the Cloncurry River, which is... And the Cloncurry is actually, as you can see, a tributary of the Flinders. And it's found to these elm trees were found to the west of where the Flinders changes from the more or less westerly course to a more or less northerly course. So they were found in this area, on the Cloncurry itself and on the Williams River here. And all of these trees were found exactly where Leichhardt said he'd go. Now, one of the elm trees near the Alice Barcoo junction, and the cursor's gone, there it is, in this area, was discovered by Captain Frederick Walker while he was searching for Burke and Wills in 1861. And on the same expedition, at five or six locations on the headwaters of the Barcoo and Thompson Rivers, so up in... That damn cursor's gone again. There it is. Somewhere in this particular stretch of country here, Walker discovered very old tracks of a large number of horses and mules. When he set out, Leichhardt had 20 mules, 7 horses and 50 bullocks with him. And the tracks Walker saw were heading northwest, and he had no doubt that they were those of Leichhardt's long-lost expedition. And over the years, other elm trees were found further west. Reports came in of a single elm tree on the headwaters of the MacArthur River. And it's up about here somewhere. And another on the Barkly Tableland near Antony's Lagoon, down this way. And in the 1950s, a tree marked L was seen at a remote waterhole between the Roper and Victoria Rivers over... in there somewhere. There's a stretch of very dry country between the two river, the two headwaters, and the waterhole's in there somewhere. And as recently as last year, trees were reported to have existed in the 1950s on an upper tributary of the Diamantina. So up in here somewhere. The upper Diamantina trees and the one near Antlers Lagoon are inland from the northern catchment, but this can be explained by my suggestion that to follow his grand plan, Leichhardt would have had to move back and forth between the headwaters of the northern rivers and the inland. And Antony's Lagoon is on Creswell Creek, which is an inland flowing stream that runs to the southwest, Creswell Creek. It's this one here. The existence of an elm tree near Antony's Lagoon suggests that Leichhardt found Creswell Creek and followed it down in the hope it would prove to be the highway to Swan River he was hoping for. Instead, it ends in Lake Tarrabool at the end here, which is a giant flood out on the west side of the Barkly Tableland, and it's usually waterless except after very heavy rain. Apart from elm trees, other possible clues were found, and in 1860, explorer McDowell Stewart found what he believed were old horse tracks near Tennant Creek. Now that you can see it anyway, there. That's southwest of Lake Tarrabool, and at Newcastle Waters in 1862, he saw a boy he thought was of mixed Aboriginal European descent northwest of Lake Tarrabool, up this area somewhere. In the mid-1880s on Wave Hill Station, I haven't got it marked. This map, I had a professionally drawn map to bring, but I could not open the file at all, so I had to use this homemade map. Wave Hill's in about this area here somewhere. So it abuts the northern edge, as you can see, of the Tanami Desert. And in the mid-1880s, the settlers there shot dead a mixed-race man who was old enough to have been father by one of Leichhardt's party. And in about 1910, an Aboriginal woman from the Tanami told of bullocks wearing bells in her country before there were any settlers in the wider region. So a woman was taken from Tanami to Darwin, probably for a murder case as a witness or something, and she told the story of seeing bullocks with bells before there were any settlers anywhere. Another story comes from Jack Beasley, who was a very early stockman in the Victoria River District up in here. And Jack claimed that in the desert south of Wave Hill, he met an old Aboriginal woman who had an adult son of mixed Aboriginal European descent. And presumably the son was middle-aged because, quote, from her account of his origin, Jack formed the opinion that he was the son of a member of Leichhardt's party, unquote. Now, stories of mixed-race people and possible old horse tracks may have only a tenuous link to Leichhardt, but not so the Leichhardt plate now in the collection of the National Museum. We can go back to that. There it is. This plate made from brass and stamped, as you can see, with Ludwig Leichhardt, 1848. And this is where Matt's gazumped me. It was originally attached to remains of an old gun. And this gun was found in the early 1900s by an Aboriginal who, believe it or not, was named Jackie, and who was then working for a white man named Charles Harding. I'll go through this again because it might help you remember the details, and it's easier for me to do that. Now, Harding, as Matt said, was a drover who worked in the East Kimberley country in the late 1800s or early 1900s. And apparently he did some prospecting in the arid country to the south, probably during the wet season when the droving wasn't possible, but the rains made water readily available in the desert. And it was during one of his prospecting trips that Jackie found the gun with the plate attached and gave it to Harding. Harding discarded the gun, but kept the plate, which he said to have treasured, but he made no attempt to seek publicity or to make money from its discovery. So in other words, he wasn't trying to big note himself or get rich, so almost certainly it was not a hoax that he had perpetrated himself. In about 1918, he gave it to the young teenage acquaintance, Reg Bristow Smith, and ownership eventually passed to Bristow Smith's son, Geoffrey, and then to Geoffrey's widow, who sold it to the museum last year. And in the 1930s, as Matt said, the Royal Geographical Society of South Australia investigated the origin of the plate, but by this time Charles Harding was dead, so the only information available came from Bristow Smith and others who discussed the plate with Harding. From then, the society learnt that the plate had been found attached to a partly burnt and rusted firearm in a bottle tree marked with an L. This tree was said to be near Mount Inkerman, near the Musgrave Range, close to Sturt Creek, and about 90 miles from the West Australian border. And when the investigation was begun, the locations of Sturt Creek and the Western Australian border were known, but the only known Musgrave Range was the one in northern South Australia, down here, and the only known Mount Inkerman was in Queensland, over this way somewhere. The term bottle tree was another problem. In Queensland, it was the common name of Brachychiton rupestris, which is a large species of carrajong with a distinctive bottle shape. And it was thought that some Queensland bushmen might call any carrajong species a bottle tree. Ordinary carrajongs were known to exist near the South Australian Musgrave Range, but the term was also a name commonly applied to the boab, Adansonia gregorii, found in the Kimberley and Northern Victoria River District. So most of the Kimberley and the northern part of the Victoria River District through this area here. Initially, it was believed that boabs were only found in country well to the north of Sturt Creek, but it was subsequently learned that there was a scattering of boabs in a swathe of desert country north of the Gardiner Range, which you can see there, and between Sturt Creek Station and Birrandooda, so in this swathe of country here, which is the very northern edge of the Tanami. These boabs are separated from the real boab country to the north by a wide belt of open black soil grasslands and also some savanna country to the north of the grasslands. And it was also learnt that in the region where the desert boabs grow, there was a hill known to local Aborigines as Inkamani or Inkamane, I'm not too sure, but I think it's Inkamani, and that there was a Musgrave Range about 150 kilometres southwest of the Gardiner Range, so around about here somewhere. The Royal Geographical Society eventually came to the conclusion that the plate was probably genuine and it was found in the northwest Tanami. And that's more or less where the story ended for them. But what the Society didn't learn is what Dick Kimber here has since. And that is that there's a Mount Musgrave and a Mount Inkerman to the south of Alice Springs. Is that correct? Based on the information of place names, what we have then is three possible locations where the plate was found. The South Australian Musgrave Range area, a region to the south of Alice Springs, somewhere in here, and the Sturt Creek region of the northwest Tanami. So can we identify which place is the correct one, or at least the most likely? I believe that the evidence is strongly in favour of the northwest Tanami being the correct place. First, Bristow Smith family tradition is that the plate was found in the northern Tanami Desert. Second, an origin in the northern Tanami is supported by oxides and corrosion detected on the plate during recent scientific examination. These discoveries will be explained later by David Hallam, but basically there are oxides on the plate that form on brass during long-term exposure to hot, arid conditions, and corrosion, which occurs in hot, humid conditions. Now, across the tremendous vastness of the outback, it can be very hot or very cold, but humidity levels are almost always low. So development of corrosion reflecting prolonged exposure to hot, humid conditions is likely to be minimal. But the northwest Tanami Desert is within the tropical monsoon belt. In this region, the winter days are very hot and very dry, while in summer, it's very hot and very humid day and night. These alternating conditions occur much less frequently and are of much shorter duration as you move further south towards central Australia. In other words, the northern Tanami is an ideal location for the features now seen on the plate to develop. And third, Leichhardt planned to pass through a broad zone incorporating the headwaters of the North Australian rivers and the adjacent inland country and to follow any stream he found flowing inland to the west or southwest. So his plan was to follow up the Barcoo, cross to the headwaters of the Flinders, then keep to the headwaters of the northern rivers, but he wanted to find the northern extent of Sturt's desert, so he would have to leave the headwaters to go inland to do that. So I envisage a broad zone from the headwaters to the inland some distance, right across in a swathe across the north. Now, this zone would encompass the northern Tanami country and Sturt Creek, but would not come remotely close to the other two areas south of Alice Springs. Now, if we accept the plate as a genuine Leichhardt relic left in the northwest Tanami, this doesn't tell us anything about what happened to him or his expedition, but I can make a suggestion. The place where the plate appears to have been found is a relatively short distance from Sturt Creek, probably within a few days' walk, and Sturt Creek is an inland flowing stream which heads generally southwest. Given his hope of finding a stream that would lead him towards Swan River, Leichhardt would have followed Sturt Creek downstream, only to find that it ends in the salt waters of Lake Gregory. So if the plate was found in here somewhere, near the Gardiner Range, he hits the Sturt Creek, whack over, this is the southwest flowing stream. It's a creek there, but you follow the creeks, they turn into rivers, and it leads towards Swan River. He would have found that, you know, it ends in the salt waters of Lake Gregory. But at this point, when he got to Lake Gregory, his choice was either to go forward or to retreat. And there's evidence that he, or at least some of his men, went forward. In 1889, a man named Alec McPhee was working with local Aborigines at La Grange on the 90-mile beach south of Broome, where the Great Sandy Desert meets the sea. Over this area. La Grange is there, the Great Sandy Desert, the dunes come right to the coast. The Aborigines told McPhee that a white man was living in their tribal area deep in the desert, so he decided to get his horse, pack horses, and go out and investigate. His Aboriginal guides took him to Joanna Spring. That curse is gone. Curse the cursor. There it is there. It's about 600 kilometres inland from the coast, and then they made contact with their countrymen in the area. The white man turned out to be a Jungun. He was a very pale-skinned Aboriginal. But while McPhee was questioning the old people at the spring, they told him that long ago, in the country their neighbours far to the southeast, three or four mounted horsemen had entered the region from the north or northeast. Their neighbours had seen the men come and later followed their tracks and found them and their horses dead. The tracks showed they'd gone from rock outcrop to rock outcrop, no doubt hoping to find a rock hole. First their horses died, then the party split up, and one by one each of the other men also perished. Their neighbours were said to still possess items taken from the dead men and horses, including an iron axe and harness. No party of three or four horsemen is known to have gone missing in this part of the world. And remember, the Aborigines said it was long ago before 1889, which suggests that it was well before the settlers arrived in the Kimberley and Victoria River districts in the early 1880s. And well before the miners arrived on the Kimberley goldfield in 1886. Who else could it have been but Leichhardt or members of his expedition? The Aborigines at Joanna Spring told McPhee that the country of their neighbours was about 10 days' walk to the southeast, and McPhee estimated that this would amount to about 330 kilometres. 330 kilometres southeast of Joanna Spring brings you to a point about 150 kilometres south of Lake Gregory. It's over here somewhere. Out there. And most of the country between this point and Lake Gregory is relatively open and free from large sand dunes or rough range country. According to ethnographer Norman Tyndale, it's the territory of the Ildawonga people. As a result of McPhee's discovery in 1891, an expedition was sent out to explore the blank areas of the Gibson and Great Sandy Deserts and to search for traces of Leichhardt. But because of severe drought and dissension amongst the expedition members, it failed before it achieved much. 4 years later, David Carnegie succeeded in making the first known south-to-north crossing of the Great Sandy Desert. About 300 kilometres south-southeast of Joanna Spring, and judging from Tyndale's map still within the territory of the Ildawonga, he met a family of Aborigines at a native well. He named the place Family Well in their honour. It's down here. These Aborigines had in their possession part of a saddle tree, the lid from a metal matchbox, and a heavy iron tent peg, all carefully wrapped up and obviously prized by them. Somehow Carnegie obtained these items from the Aborigines. Later he sent the peg to J.A. Panton, the chief magistrate at Melbourne, who was regarded as an authority on Leichhardt. Panton's opinion was that the peg probably came from Leichhardt's expedition, though how he could have come to such a conclusion is unclear, because the peg could have been obtained from some far distant place via Aboriginal trade links, but equally, it could have been found by the Aborigines a relatively short distance from Family Well. Carnegie himself made the point that in 1895, heavy iron tent pegs were old-fashioned, and that this example was for use on a very large tent which only an expedition would carry. It's said that when Leichhardt left on his last expedition, he had with him one large tent. Finally, I should point out that since European settlement, the country of the Ildawonga and surrounding groups, that's the Western Tanami, Eastern Great Sandy Desert country, has been and remains one of the most remote and seldom visited parts of Australia. If my suggestion is correct, that three or four of Leichhardt's party perished in the area where the Tanami, Great Sandy and Gibson deserts meet, somewhere in this stretch here, it would explain why virtually no relics of his expedition were ever found. It's a region where some of the last uncontacted Aborigines remained living in the bush until the 1980s, and it's the perfect place for the remains of a lost exploring expedition to remain undiscovered for nearly 160 years. Thank you. Okay.
Mike, back on again. Thank you very much, Daryl. That was a very compelling paper on the fact that Leichhardt nearly made it, the fact that he did get across into that, well, quite terrible country between those two deserts, and that that's where the remains may still reside today. So, questions now. Please wait for the mic. Over here, please. And if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself, please.
Thank you. Harvey Marchant from the Australian National University. Given the very compelling evidence that you get, that you give for Leichhardt's track to the north, what is the basis then of the legend that he perished in the north part of the Simpson Desert, particularly in the area of the Plenty River?
As I understand it, the basis is that there were a couple of L trees found on Glen Ormiston Station and one near Altunga. I don't know who put the L trees there. I can't see Leichhardt getting as far as, say, Lake Gregory and retreating from that desert to then head to a very severe desert he knew existed. Now, when the frontier reached the Glen Ormiston area, there was a character called Jack Dick Scewthorpe, who became one of the people who claimed that he had gone out beyond the frontier and met a Leichhardt survivor, met Klassen, and had retrieved the journals of Leichhardt and Klassen. Now, Scewthorpe was regarded as, by some at least, as a bit of a charlatan. He made other claims about at different times about amazing exploits and discoveries. I think it's possible that, well, he certainly was out there. Perhaps he carved the L's to give himself some credibility, or it was somebody else, but I can't. Well, there's one other explanation, perhaps. The Aboriginal story from the Great Sandy said there were three or four horsemen who came in and perished. Now, there were eight members altogether, seven or eight. There's three or four unaccounted for, but perhaps five. And they could have died from any number of causes before they got to the Great Sandy, but equally they could have had a fight amongst themselves, and some said, we're going to go back. But again, I would ask, why would a dissenting group, almost certainly not Leichhardt's group, go back and then cut into totally unknown desert country rather than follow their outward route where they knew where the water was? And why would they head towards that terribly severe desert that they almost certainly knew was there? Because I can't imagine that they wouldn't have asked Leichhardt, why are we going way up north rather than direct, if they hadn't heard about the discoveries of Sturt themselves. So I just can't understand why any of Leichhardt's team would have gone down there. Someone else might provide a good answer. I can't.
Dick?
Sorry, Dick Kimber. I really think Daryl's presented an excellent case, and I applaud him for that. I also take his earlier point that everywhere except Tasmania, Leichhardt's been found by various people. That's an important point, and the only other point I'll make at this stage, because I'm due to talk later, is that my understanding is that he had a friend called Reverend Clark, whom he also said, I intend to go direct to as direct as I can. And he had the information from Sturt that Eyre Creek would provide a good depot for anyone intending to go around the desert he'd found. So I'll leave it at that at this point, but I think you've presented an excellent case, Daryl, and commend you for it. Thank you.
Thanks, Dick.
Thanks, Dick.
I can just say that Leichhardt outlined the plan that I've outlined here in about four or five separate letters when he was on the frontier, about ready to go. And I can't see him suddenly changing his mind. He had that Humboldtian grand plan. going direct would do away with that.
Sure.
Next.
Henry.
Henry Nix, I'd simply confirm that. And he wrote three letters to his brother-in-law in Germany. One was to the Sydney Morning Herald in the days before he left.
That's right.
On his last expedition.
Absolutely.
In which he made it very clear which track he would take.
Yep.
And it wasn't due west.
And why would you? You know, this terrible desert, you know. I mean, and he had that plan. He had that plan.
He had the plan.
Thanks, Henry. Rod?
Rod Ho. Thinking about the L trees in southwest Queensland, wasn't Landsborough through there as well? Might they not be his?
On the Flinders River, Landsborough followed that down in 1860 or 61, I think, 61. But he kept to the north side and the west east side of the river all the way. And when he marked a tree, he marked it L. And usually in Roman numerals, the number of his camp was 8 or something like that. It wasn't just a plain L. And several of his trees marked L. One was found by Gregory in 1858, and one was found by Walker in 1861. And there's no way that they could misidentify a tree carved a couple of years earlier. Well, in Gregory's case, of course, it was before Landsborough. But Walker wouldn't have misidentified. Another one was found in 1864. Again, Leichhardt would have carved it in 1848, Landsborough in 1861. These men were bushmen. They wouldn't mistake a recently cut tree with one of the very old ones. So that's the one of the main reasons. Also, a number of these trees were found outside Landsborough's track. For instance, on the Conquo River, there were two different lots found there. So I don't think there's any doubt that they're Leichhardt trees.
Another question, Graham.
Graham Clifton, can you tell us a bit more about the bullock and the bell that the Aboriginal lady found in the Tanami Desert? Is there any other explanation?
No.
Of how could it got there other than Leichhardt?
I haven't got any other explanation. We have to take these things at face value. This woman was apparently taken from the Tanami to Darwin and told the story. I've only got the one account written by a policeman who just basically said what I've told you. It's when she said there were no white men in the wider region, well, perhaps her wider region wasn't wide enough and they were on the telegraph line or somewhere. Possibly it strayed that far. It's, you know, it's all possible. But it's got, there are alternative explanations for that and also for the old horse track supposedly seen by McDowell Stewart. But if you put it in the context of Leichhardt's planned route, they're possibly evidence. I said they were tenuous. That's all I can say.
A good range of questions, and we've got room for a couple more. Anyone else? Dick has a second question, but anyone? Okay, Dick.
Thank you again. It's Dick Kimber. It's more a comment than a question, is that Leichhardt was highly upset by Major Mitchell's comment that he was nothing but a damned coaster. And I think that's an important point in regard to the possibility of this other alternative case of him travelling more directly. I found it very interesting that I think he was looking for diprotodons when he did his first trip. He's clearly very interested in them and found some recent bones. But I think that possibility of him being challenged by Mitchell on what I thought, as Matthew said, was a fantastic first trip, but he's just a damn coaster after that, is possibility of him changing his route plan. That's all I'd like to say. Thank you.
Thanks, Dick. And if he had followed the plan to try and map the northern extent of Sturt's Desert and the headwaters of the rivers, then he would have been moving into the inland quite a bit. I mean, the headwaters are already well inland, but he was going to be inland from there. And you do have reports of the L tree on Creswell Creek and on the upper Diamantina, which are inland from the northern watersheds. And, of course, the horse tracks and the buoy and the bullet and the bell. So you couldn't really call him a coaster within that plan. Mitchell could, but nobody else would.
Rather typical of Mitchell.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your questions and Darrell for your answers. So we're just about at time.
Is there another minute?
Oh, I'll give you a minute.
I just wanted to add that a report was recorded from Aborigines in Western Australia about a number of whites dying on a salt lake in Western Australia. And I think it was John Forrest who went out to investigate. And he went as far as Lake Bali here and decided that the reports, for various reasons, decided the reports related to a land-seeking expedition that passed through the country and nobody had died, but there were horses there. But I still wonder if perhaps there were these white men who perished near a salt lake further up, and the story was passed along the Aboriginal networks. And by the time it got down to this area, well, of course, people couldn't really say where it was, except they knew the story. It was somewhere up to the north. It's remotely possible that the story they heard there was about these men who perished where I suggest. That's all.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Darryl. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
I don't know about you, but I feel that I was really there with Leica, you know, trying to find that way forward. And it is just such a fascinating question to try to understand where he ended up.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.